Gideon sat in the hot, scrubbed room where she had eaten breakfast and was given a meal of pallid white meat and a bunch of leaves. It was good that she was alone. She had no clue what to do with it. She ate the meat with a fork. You didn't need a knife. It was so tender that it flaked away if you touched it. And ate the leaves one by one with her fingers. She realized partway through that it was probably a salad.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 10. Am I being a creep? We're so excited. We have Carol here with us today.
Hello. I'm also excited. I'm in like fandom communities, so I've done a lot of yapping, done like a little bit of fan art, but not a lot. TikTok cosplay is kind of my thing.
What characters have you cosplayed?
Most of them.
That is a good episode.
Yeah,
title.
That's perfect.
Settled on that one.
Yeah. It's so hard now that we're like this far into the book to signal enough, but not to spoil it. Like,
yeah,
balance it, because like hopefully everybody who listens is happy with spoilers, but we're sharing promotional materials to the general public and we don't want to be like, we're on the one where Magnus dies.
Yeah, god, there was so much, speaking of spoilers, there was so much in this chapter as I read it back that I was like, how did I not see this?
Oh my god, first I know read? She's like, awful,
and like the amount that she is so confident and present and doesn't actually seem to be, she's wearing a glamour but she's not putting on an act, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mir loves to write these things as, no, this could be literally true, and like Kitharea is such a fantastic example of that, where like she's really quite earnest, she's like selective about how she expresses it, but it's a really insidious way of being deceptive.
I am obsessed with Kitharea's claim later in the book that she didn't lie, because of course we don't know that that's true. She's the one saying it. So on one level, I'm rereading everything that she said for the truth. And on the other hand, I'm like, yeah, I could also say that I've never lied.
The thing that she said about her childhood, like imagining being a brother or sister of the ninth, I was wondering, does that match up with her being a second generation Lictor? Like, was the ninth house enough of a thing for that to be a true anecdote? I feel like it might be.
I really don't have a clear timeline in terms of actual years between John's ascension and the completion of the houses.
Yeah, yeah. I find that really confusing as well.
Yeah. That's the sort of detail that doesn't stick in my brain ever, even if I have access to it. So,
like, let's just explore that for a second. So Kitharea would be looking at this, at these children, being like, oh, this is what I wanted for myself as a child. Like, is that the vibe that she's kind of acknowledging in her brain?
I would love to know how much of that is sincere, because it comes across as sincere, but so does a lot of the things that she says that are not. So
I like, we were talking about Ianthe in our last recording, and like about manipulation when you know something that the listener doesn't know. Kitharea, to get to this point, has had to be repeatedly very strategic, and her suddenly like dropping that approach doesn't make sense. Like,
she's mid-mission.
Yeah, she's mid-mission. And what I don't know, is she toying with Gideon here, or is she like manipulating Gideon here?
Or is she just vastly underestimating Gideon? Or correctly estimating Gideon, honestly. Or yeah. Does she just think there's no way this idiot child is going to suspect anything?
It seems like there's some parallels to how Harrow communicates with Gideon, where Harrow will make reference to things that she knows Gideon doesn't know. And it seems like it's tinged with this like teasing, kind of mocking, kind of gloating of like, I know something you don't know, but also sort of this like desire to be seen and this sort of desire to divulge, which you also see Gideon really struggling with in this moment.
Yeah, I see that being a real thing too, for someone who is 10,000 years old and not understood by anyone. Mm-hmm. And has not been understood by anyone in 10,000 years. Like, I feel like you would have that kind of powerful desire to be seen and divulge things, probably. And maybe she sees it as an opportunity. This is an idiot child again. I can say whatever I want.
And Gideon, Gideon's familiarity with this kind of dynamic may also be a thing that it means that she's skipping past some of Gideon's guards.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gideon is now being talked to in this way that is so intimately familiar to her. Even though, but now it's couched in all this beauty and this gentleness and this floweriness that is like, from the beginning, the description of Gideon going into this garden is of the smells and the intoxication of the sensation of it. Like, before she even sees Dulcinea, Gideon is starting to be intoxicated by the environment, and Dulcinea is expressed as a wilting flower. Like, so there's this manipulation, but it's all in this beautiful art.
She's also perfectly primed to be manipulated in this moment too. Like, the way that we set up, like, how Gideon's been feeling all day, like, she wants to be useful. She was hoping that she could come here and be useful, and the hero's not giving her that opportunity. And then all of a sudden, here's this beautiful woman that needs her to help her with her chair or whatever. And yes, oh my god,
who's teasing her just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to propose also that Kithareya is being just a little bit naive here, because she thinks she's safe to say things to Gideon because Gideon is a true believer under a genuine religious vow of silence.
That's true.
Kithareya probably believes that Gideon is not having conversations with anyone and won't for the foreseeable future. She has no idea that Gideon could just, like, skip home and repeat everything to Harrow.
That's true. Yeah. She is kind of the perfect target for just pressure release.
Mm-hmm. And she says specifically, she loves a captive listener. And this is, like, we realize now in rereading, a fucking villain monologue.
Yeah.
Full on.
It's like, god damn it, you got me monologuing again.
Gideon Nav, you sly dog. I want to dig into this salad moment.
Okay, let's do this.
Okay, we don't have to go all the way salad fingers. I just actually want to point out, I think that this is Gideon's first experience of fish.
Yes.
He does not recognize this white flaky meat, which is easily recognized as, like, a well-cooked fish. But Gideon doesn't even recognize fish. She's totally confused by the idea of a meat that you can cut with a fork, and the idea of this, like, pale, flaky. She's like, it's meat. Like, I can tell that it's meat, but beyond that, I have no frame of reference for this.
It honestly really surprises me that she has a frame of reference for meat.
Yeah.
I don't know what sort of meat they're getting on the Ninth House. Certainly wouldn't be common.
Could be that there's meat in comic books.
Oh, that's true.
And so she's seen, like, depictions of steak, depictions of a chicken leg, something like that.
But counterpoint, if they have enough agricultural infrastructure that there are fresh vegetables, it wouldn't be inefficient. So it would be efficient, and it would make sense to have animal husbandry as part of a full circle agricultural program. Mm-hmm. If it's an agricultural settlement, they would have to have a certain degree of scale and would be having to import all their foods besides the snow leeks to assume that there are no animals on the Ninth.
I think that there's some clues that there might be animals on the Ninth, because Gideon makes reference to barking and I think maybe cats. Like, there seems to be an awareness of human-animal interactions as, at the very least, kind of a cultural touchstone. And probably if there's wool, somebody's eating mutton. But
I was about to say, I think that, like,
animal sheep as a culture isn't, like, described.
No.
There's definitely, like, cold weather animals, or, like, you know, sheep's yaks, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it could be that they're...
And cats, like, if we look at, intercontinental settling, you often get vermin with that. And cats are one of those things that we see introduced to settlements over and over again to help prevent that from taking hold while they're still trying to establish themselves agriculturally.
Especially if you're in, like, this self-contained, like, essentially planetary space station type of thing where they have to have the climate control and everything, that's very important. Rodents really like chewing on wires, so I feel like you would want to really prioritize pest control in that way, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, given that it's a dirt land-based one, I think that's the thing we have to factor for. Because you also think of, like, space agriculture, which you think of as hydroponics, highly sanitized, where you're much less likely to get that kind of thing in terms of, like, how science fiction often portrays agriculture. But we're talking about, like, skeletons honed in the dirt, so I'm leaning more towards that organic issues are concerned.
I do feel like I want to push back on the idea of animal agriculture as an efficient solution, because snow leeks are literally the only vegetable that there is textual evidence for. We don't see any kind of like grazing land kind of descriptions. Yeah. And for sure, you cannot live on leeks. That is not an efficient, like, leeks are very low calorie. Yeah. But we know that there are nutrient pastes that substantially comprise their diet. And it's very possible that nutrient pastes are the primary source of calories on the ninth, and that the snow leeks are basically there as a source of, you know, iron, vitamin K, that kind of thing.
A garnish. Yeah.
And in this chapter, it actually talks about non-cultivated living things. It talks about mosses and spores. So those are extremely primitive organisms, right? So mosses were like the first land-based photosynthesizing. Mosses and liverworts were the first things to emerge from the edge of the sea, like extremely primitive. All they need is somewhere to grab onto and some moisture. So that to me also implies that there's a very limited amount of non-imported soils. Like there's things here, there's places for things to grow more because it's in caves.
I just realized, why would they not do lab grown meat? They do necromancy. They do lab grown meat.
Yeah, I think lab grown meat is really highly probable in the sense that it's really highly scalable. And a lot of what we're looking at for ninth nutrition has been implied to be like produced, really processed, like this, you know, protein porridge or whatever. Porridge and sandwich.
Porridges and sandwich bags.
I feel like that's the sort of thing that it seems very probable that it exists. I don't know how likely it is that it's like widely distributed or evenly distributed. I think that's unlikely.
I want to open the floor here for cannibalism.
If you're in a culture that's fine with bringing back to the people back from the dead-ish for forced labor, you're fine with them bringing their mechanical parts back for forced labor, and that's an expected thing of your culture.
And integrating other parts of their body, including rendering fat for other everyday household products.
We've got human skin vellum.
Where is there a line?
Especially if it's lab-grown, if it's not technically from a person.
Yeah, and it also seems with Gideon's reaction in chapter 9 to soap, there isn't a standard on revulsion here. There does seem to be some disagreement in terms of how far you can take this disregard for people's own right to decide what happens to their body after they die. And soul, while we're on it, because it definitely seems like the necromancy in these books, like, will be like, I'm gonna take your spirit juice and use it to make a war crime.
I want to throw out, symptoms of prion disease include dementia, unstable movement, muscle weakness, jerking muscle movements, difficulty with speech and coordination, changes in personality and mood, and hallucinations.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, there was definitely a reaction to Harrow soup.
There was. I would say there's more of a reaction to Harrow soup than to the suggestion of Gideon Prime and Kithorea's body.
True. You're talking. I don't know what the fuck is being talked about right now in terms of specifically the reaction, or reaction A and reaction B. Like, do you mean?
John was really mad that Harrow tricked him into doing cannibalism because he hadn't done cannibalism in a long time and hadn't planned to do it again.
And maybe it carries a bit of baggage for him.
I could see that being the case.
He was the only one who expressed that opinion. And Ianthe's cannibalism of Babs while he was alive did not attract a lot of attention or revulsion by the main cast of Gideon. Boy.
I mean, they were distracted by other things, to be fair.
Gideon personally was a little weirded out by it, but everyone else was like, yeah, third's gonna third. So if it's okay to eat alive people. And the other part of the comparison I was drawing in Harrow the Ninth Clare is John was considerably more offended at having had bone soup than he was when Harrow told him that the Saint of Duty had been engaging in the love that must not be named.
Right, right. Okay, thank you for laying all those pieces out on the table for me. I'm going to need about 15 seconds of dead air.
Just stare into the middle distance for a little bit.
Listen, the lictors are fucked up.
Oh, God.
Oh. There's so many moments that I have with this series where there's stuff that once you think of it, it's so obvious and makes so much sense given the context of everything else and how fucked up the society in general is. But you don't think about it until you think about it. And then you do have to react to it every time.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't gotten super juicy and political on this for a second, and I'm not going to get specific, but I do want to identify that this is the same feeling when you like learn something awful about the world. And then every time you see this injustice happening again, your body is like, oh, I can't ever unsee that again. And like now in rereading these books as well, like we see even just the suggestions and our body's like, here we go. Like, I think one of the reasons why this book creates such intensity of relationships is we have to process these feelings together. They're in really intense feelings and they're not nice to hold alone. This is why we scream text our friends who recommend the book to us.
This horrible series that I love very much.
It's really interesting to look at this chapter, having just talked about chapter 9. This chapter and the previous chapter both set up a dichotomy between two different houses. Chapter 9 set up this contrast between the wholesomeness and warmth and a beautiful perfection of Magnus versus the really conniving, manipulative meanness of Ianthe. And yes, Claire, I know that that has just as many heart emojis for you. And this one does a really similar trick where it sets up the harshness and the judgment and the disgust of the Eighth with the curiosity and warmth and playfulness of the Seventh. And that offset does a really similar trick to the last chapter. And so it almost gives us this like 2x2 grid of characters to play with.
Yeah. And Muir is both showing us what Gideon's emotional journey is, but it's also like priming us to have various specific relationships with these houses.
Fuck the Eighth on contact.
God, I hate that fucking guy. But I love Colm. I love Colm, actually. Like, I immediately sympathized with Colm. I'm like, I was like, oh, buddy, I don't know what's going to happen to you, but I already feel bad.
Okay, how old do you think Colm is? Because I realized as I was reading it, I've been picturing him as like 55 for some reason. And then it says he's like, what did it say? A fair bit older than Gideon herself. So that sounds like he could be like 28, 33.
In the cohort intelligence files at the back, Judith doesn't even know his first name and estimates his age at 32, 34, or 37. Because she knows that there's three brothers of the same age, but she doesn't know which one he is.
Okay. So that's so much younger than I was picked. I guess he's just always described as just like drained, which makes sense.
Age check.
36.
36? 38? You care?
Hang on.
No. I mean your own.
No, I understand the question.
Like
37. I'm 37.
Because I found like I find Colm relatable in some really like mundane, comforting ways where I'm like, this particular type of tired.
Yeah.
It's like I'm seeing this teenager that I constantly have to fucking deal with once again be a little shit to someone who is probably having their own bad time.
He's old.
Because we're all having a bad time here. And he's just like, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, how did they describe it? It was like polite, though not apologetic. For some reason, that stands out to me as like, yeah, I know exactly what that vibe is. Like, this is a thing that he has to do.
What yeah. do you think Tamsin Muir means when she describes Colm as nuggety?
Oh, I know, because I used to have, okay, so I'm like, I've been a bit of a gym nut in the past many years of my life, but I used to have like a deep revulsion to like big muscly dudes because I find the body bulgy. I find bodybuilder masculine people bulgy in a way that's like kind of like, and that's when I see nuggety, that's yep.
Because they do get weird lumps places. Okay. And yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And like I've done enough powerlifting that I like respect the labor that they're putting in, but to me the visual is lumpy. Can I talk about one of my favorite paragraphs in this?
Yes, but please.
It starts with Gideon was raw for a fight.
Oh and my gosh! Yes.
And then it describes a feeling and a thought process with which I have very fond familiarity. So I have had the luck of having very few actual fights for my own safety or well-being. I've had many more that have been consensual and for sport. I'm not talking about the first one. I'm talking about the second one. This feeling of like gotten yourself high, like you're all like someone's just pressed your button and you're like, there is someone here I can fight. Like there's a part of you that's like, this person, I could fight them and they could fight me and it would be interesting. Like to satisfy that need to resolve your anxiety physically.
I interpreted this so differently because I think the fact that there was somebody in front of her who was annoying her was irrelevant to how badly she wanted to get into a knockdown dragout fight. Because 2 pages later, she is holding a sword and she's like, I want to get in a fight. I think that what's happening to her is that she hasn't trained in 3 days. And she went from training every single day really intensely for long hours to being completely socially isolated. And she's just like, I just want to hit something. I want to get hit. I want to hit something. That's what I want.
I don't think we're talking about separate things. I think we're talking about two things that the thing that you describe then leads to maybe the thing that I described.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I see that. One of the most brutal training sessions that I have ever had in my life. I had been training really frequently at that point and was about to go on a long trip. And I was taking my equipment with me and planning to like find opportunities to fight while I was traveling, but I didn't know how much I'd be able to fight over potentially multiple months. And so the last fight that I did at my kind of home training, I made a set of rules for myself that was like, I can't say no to a fight. I can't be the one who ends the fight. And I can't be the reason that nobody's fighting at any particular moment. This is not an appropriate and self-respecting framework. I had gone through a really big breakup right at that moment. I was not okay.
Oh, no. I want to circle back to that stress relief cycle that I described earlier.
So it turned out, and Claire mentioned it in a previous episode, that when you train with people who are familiar, often you lose to the same shot over and over again. Because once your opponent finds the shot that works, they don't want to find another one. They want that one. And unfortunately, at my home training on that particular week, we had one of the best fighters in the region. And everybody else was kind of taking it easy. And so I fought him for about 3 hours. Cool. And the shot that he was really able to get on me was a thigh shot.
Oh, and I've had that. I know that. What kind of shield were you fighting with?
I was fighting Case.
Oh, sweetheart. Oh,
no. That might have been when I was doing sword and buckler.
That's not much better. Case is a style fought with two full-length swords, one in each hand.
Oh.
Extremely technically challenging, and it is extremely physically active because your hands are constantly alternating between which one is taking the offensive role and which one is taking the defensive role, rather than the more passive protective style of using a full shield.
That's the fight that I think of when I hear Gideon talking about wanting to fight bloody, is the feeling that I had when I decided to set that fight up for myself. And I did not regret that fight at the time. In hindsight, I look at that and I'm like, that was a cry for help.
Yes.
But at the time, I was like, yeah, that's what I signed up for.
I feel like there are worse coping mechanisms
I agree.
than that, honestly.
It's an interesting one because it's one where that coping mechanism is actually pretty common. Like I could share my own I was like in a super weird space and I needed to fight it out story, but they all come with this like tension of expecting other people to participate in your own coping. And so there's like and this is what's happening is that Gideon is like getting herself ramped up in her head, really being in her body and all of her stress and all of her unresolved tension. And Colm is not that vibe.
He's
There
the
is
adult in the room.
fighting against someone who is not buying into your energy is in its own way activating.
It reminds me of what you're supposed to do when a toddler's throwing a tantrum, and what I always found very effective, which is just if you can keep yourself calm and regulated, they really burn it out pretty quick because it just has nothing to feed the fire.
Yeah, you're like just burn, burn, baby, burn. It's an interesting headspace. You stop thinking about the consequences of your choices and you are so present with your body's need to act.
I think it's kind of worse than that because she is actively thinking of the consequences. She's thinking about fighting bloody. She's thinking about fighting until people are severely injured, fighting until she is killed. And I think that this should maybe be looked at as a self-harm framework. And I think that like that is the way that I was engaging with fighting. And if I am honest, running at the time as well. If I, had a fight with my partner or was feeling rejected or was feeling bad about myself, I pushed too hard in athleticism as the way to process that. And because athleticism is so valued, people were really supportive and they were like, oh, what a healthy coping mechanism. And it wasn't, it was self-harm.
I feel like I've known a lot of people like that. I think it's
Yeah,
that I think that's very common.
it's you'll see it like after people quit drinking. You'll see it after people end a relationship in a really emotionally energetic way. Like the body needs to do a thing and we have no support or guidance to regulate that and make sure that it's safe. And I literally have a rule that I'm not allowed to hurt myself with exercise. I had to make that rule for myself because it is so socially valued. Like, yeah, get it, movement, get it out of your system. Like, but yeah, Gideon is like, has in the previous chapter met another older, neutral, not aggressive or hostile or judgmental fellow as all and had a completely different emotional reaction. Gideon is in that tantrum energy. There's like, she doesn't have the capacity, the skills, the familiarity with this particular feeling to do anything but like spin herself up.
I think it also points to the relationship between disgust and violence that she's experienced in her childhood, because we see in this paragraph, she's reminded viscerally of all of the ways that people in the ninth looked at her throughout her whole childhood, all the way going back to when the Lord and Lady of Dribber were still alive. And of course, we as readers know now that the way that they were looking at her was phobic, not because they found her personally disgusting, but because of the nerve gas thing. They were literally afraid of her, not, socially disgusted by her. But she has that feeling of people are looking at me with disgust. I know what that's like. And she goes straight to engineering her own death.
That's like exactly what I was going to bring up, actually. And I was thinking because she lists off, it's like Lacrimorta looked at her, it's like the parents looked at her, and it's like Crux looked at her. And I was thinking she has kind of connected via Crux, people being disgusted with her to violence happening to her. Like, I feel like that it kind of makes sense that her mind would immediately jump there because in her experience, that's kind of what tends to happen.
It also maybe also supports the multi-death theory because she very casually includes dying in this strategy.
I agree.
Maybe she's literally never even thought that it's weird that she just like wakes up after basically being killed.
I feel like there's no way she's aware that she's dead. I think that she would at least mention like, "Hey, I can't die." But I do think that she has been kind of conditioned to not value her own health and safety for many reasons, but one of them being because it doesn't seem to matter very much if she does or doesn't. She's always been fine.
Always been fine, and like, should she die, she doesn't really have much of a determination over what happens next anyway.
Yeah.
Which, like, begs the question, what does Gideon think of her own death? Like, there's all these little implications about what she thinks of her own death. But, like, spoilers, she thinks pretty lightly of it. She's willing to use it as a tool.
She clearly thinks about dying a lot.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of it is the sort of social normalization of, like, you die and then you continue. Like, you die and then your bones just keep on existing in the community. You still go to church. Like, it's maybe just feels less like a big deal and more like just kind of a, like, point. And then, like, you continue living your life, not having any choice about what you're going to do with it, and serving the Ninth House forever, which to her feels pretty similar to how life is.
Yeah.
There's this really interesting ambivalence that Gideon displays towards disability. She describes Colum has a gross looking stump, which she admired. He has a finger that he's lost, presumably in combat. It seems like she's noticing that his armor seems like it's seen real use and he's got this injury. And so on the one hand, she's like, this is a guy who has been in battle. This is a guy who, like, has done the thing that I want to do. I love that. But she also perceives his visible disability as disgusting, which feels like it's in tension with kind of the glorification of war. And coming from kind of a eugenic scholarship perspective, I'm like, that tells me that this is in line with the body politics of the house, and that the imperfect body, the wounded body, the disabled body is treated as unsightly in a way that really closely mirrors certainly 19th and early 20th century U.S. legal history and other places as well.
I have to assume it's unusual that he didn't get it replaced, especially as the cavalier of one of the houses.
That's a really good point, that Aglaemine got a whole new leg.
And it wasn't a good leg, but, like, she got it.
Yeah, why wasn't his finger replaced?
Was it his choice?
It could be, like, an aesthetic. I mean, maybe that's a street cred thing of, like, yeah, I've seen some shit. I've lost a finger.
It talks about the, like, the reason that Colum exists is in service to the adept of his house. So, like, I actually don't know if Colum has full agency over those decisions.
I almost wouldn't think that he would. That's and it seems like, from Silas's perspective, if Colum exists mostly as a battery, it doesn't matter if he has fingers.
Guys, what if, do you think Silas is using that fucking finger for something?
I wouldn't put it past him.
I wouldn't like that question.
If a pocket battery?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's like something about the connection or something. I don't like it.
We're all making the same face, and it's not a good one. We just smelled something very sick.
I don't like that. Man, I'd be perpetually disgruntled, too.
Yeah. Poor Colum, for real.
Again, another reason to be like, oh, Colum. Like, I feel in some very, like, calm. I don't know. I can only describe it as calm. But, like, yeah, Colum's fatigue and resignation in his manner is very relatable.
Yeah. Resignation is a very good word.
He was dealt a bad hand in life and death.
I imagine that under different circumstances, I think Colum and Gideon could have gotten along very well.
I was going to say Colum and Ordis.
Them too. Let's just out and, like, find out what they're all nerdy about.
Be buds.
Colum and Ordis. I think Colum would have been relieved to see Ordis and to, like, I don't know, hear his vibes.
I feel like they wouldn't have, like, been friends exact. Like, I feel like they would have been a mismatch of vibes, but they would have, like, gotten each other.
They would have, like, nodded at each other understandingly every day. Like, hey, man, still being
respected and connected. And
yeah.
This is an aside, but I think Ordis and Magnus would have had a lovely time.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been. I honestly wish for Ordis that he would have gotten to go to Cannon House, because I think he would have enjoyed a lot of it. Like, just a lot of the people.
And he would have nerded out over the idea of, like, the historical. Like, he loves history and poetry, and he's like, yeah, he would have been looking to read all the books.
Him and Abigail could have been hunting for artifacts together.
He's just going to go back with them to the fourth and everyone's going to be okay and read poetry.
Perfect.
I mean, I also think that Ordis and Kithereo would have gotten along if she hadn't been trying to murder everybody.
Yeah.
Dorks. About they love it. Yeah. Love it. I'm like just seeing like Ordis and Kithereo like reading to each other in the courtyard.
I was absolutely picturing him reading her a book while she lounged. 100%. His book, maybe.
Oh. So as Claire described, Gideon is coming into this courtyard having just been absolutely insulted and tossed out of a room she was going to leave anyway. So she is feeling lonely and frustrated and impulsive, and now she is just overwhelmed with sights and smells and lights and colors, and Kithereo is laid out in a clingy, diaphanous dress under a ridiculous hat reading a novel, and Gideon is absolutely boned in every direction.
And she needs help. She needs assistance.
Don't go.
Oh, I need you to be strong, big and strong and masculine. I remember that being there's a phrase in there where she can't get the chair and she feels emasculated. And that was kind of my first personal introduction to the idea that like a woman could have masculinity and like feel emasculated. And that was an important realization for my little brain.
Rereading this reminded me of when Knight, who was on the show last week, read this book for the first time because he was living with me at the time. And when he got to this chapter, he was like, I think it's really weird that I've never heard any Gideon Dulcinea ship content. It seems like this would be like the main ship. And I was like, yeah, that's weird. I don't know, man.
Honestly, I am kind of surprised there's not more.
People have explored the idea of ship content with these, and like it's continues to be upsetting.
There is, of course, a much more overtly flirty character to the sort of cat and mouse that Kithereo is doing versus the more on its face cruel cat and mouse that Harrow does.
Yeah.
It is interesting though, like you were saying earlier, it is a very similar dynamic, but just sort of glossed over in a different aesthetic sort of filter. Gideon has a type. The type is horrible.
Oh.
Also just so easy to manipulate, and it makes me sad, but I also am I understand it so deeply, and maybe that says something about me that I'm like, oh no, of course.
Oh, me too. Time I encounter this scene, I'm like, I fall for Kithereo every time. She would murder me. Absolutely.
I'd be happy about it.
Gideon is so lonely and feels so rejected. And Kithereo is like, I could have seen myself having the same life as you. It just didn't turn out that way. And she's so interested and curious and unoffended and relaxed. And that's literally intoxicating to Gideon. She's never had somebody be relaxed with her.
God, that's true. And Kithereo talks a lot more for a lot more length than I think many other scenes in this book so far. Like, we are not left to Gideon's internal dialogue. Gideon's mind is taken up with this beautiful lilting voice that is entirely focused on her. And so not only is Kithereo quite relaxed because she feels very safe with this child who has no idea what's going on, but like Gideon doesn't have to be listening to her inner voice right now. And as someone who has a relatably busy inner voice, that's really nice.
And also, because of that, we are not really analyzing the situation in the way that Gideon's not. And I think that's probably part of why, like, as I said, it's very obvious that this is a villain and there's something going on. But I certainly didn't notice it the first read. I think a lot of people don't. And I think that's maybe why, because we're just in it in the way that Gideon is.
I have introduced probably 7 or 8 people to this book, and only one person clocked Kithareya by this scene. And I was shocked because it was somebody who doesn't read a lot. Mm. And that person was like, oh, this is the disabled person. And the trope is the disabled person is actually the threat. And I was like, you got me there.
There you go. I remember being absolutely delighted to meet Dulcinea and being so excited to meet like the disabled love interest, where it's like, finally, we have the contrast to Harrow. Gideon gets to be happy. They're going to have a cute thing. There's going to be a little bit of a love triangle. Like, I had a whole story played out in my head over this lovely treat that we finally get. We just met Magnus. Like, I'm like, oh, we get to like people now.
Yeah, it was like, oh, Gideon gets to feel needed and useful and noticed and care. This is everything that she wants and that I want for her.
Yeah. Oof.
So taking the lens that Kithareya was telling the truth when she said that she never lied, there's so much content in this scene.
Mm-hmm. I honestly do get the sense that she's being like a little bit vulnerable here for probably a lot of those reasons that we were talking about, because she just doesn't feel like it's a threat and probably wants to be.
I prefer that reading. I think it's possible that she was lying when she said she doesn't lie, because you can lie about that. But I do think that taking this as true kind of gives us more interesting stuff to play with.
And it, looking at the language, reinforces our idea that she thinks she's safe because she thinks that Gideon is actually observing vows of silence. Mm-hmm. Because if she's not lying, then I know you're doing penance and can't talk.
I get to do a little monologue.
I'm reminded very much of the consumptive Victorian beauty kind of. But yeah, both in how she's presenting herself as this tragic, picturesque, like extremely aesthetic figure.
So aesthetic.
And the way that she describes her fantasy at 13 of going in and becoming a nun in the ninth house and fading away beautifully in the dark, surrounded by prayer. And then she's like, oh, but then I learned about the face paint and that ruined the tableau for me. Absolutely
not.
Not
the aesthetic. Yeah, I feel like Kithareya would probably really enjoy Tumblr in a different way than John did. Kithareya is like so weirdly, she's a special character to me as somebody who is like, I am a disabled person that has stuff specifically with my lungs. And she is such, like, it's weird to say that she's good representation, but I kind of feel like she is. Like, I connect to her whole deal so much, and it feels very authentic in a way that a lot of similar attempts at representation kind of don't.
I agree, and I think it's amazing that Tamsin Muir did such a good job of not subverting exactly, but playing with some of these existing tropes, because it seems like, how, you know, how is it so okay that she is this wilting flower, consumptive princess, a trope, but it like works? And it's, you know, it's in part because it's played up, it's an act, like, but she's also not faking the disability. She is really disabled. She's mm-hmm. also using it. It's really interesting to think about Kithareya in this moment, kind of through that lens of lobbying pity as a way of meeting her needs, but she is also disabled, and like, actually disabled people also have to perform disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it rings true on so many different layers. And there's the thing of like, so her suffering for 10,000 years doesn't excuse the things that she does. It does explain it to a certain, like, you do kind of relate to it a little bit. It just makes the whole thing so much more interesting.
There's also the disabled experience of like being kind of fucking fed up with playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's a little bit of a relief in her, and she's like, she's fatigued, she's resentful, she's on a mission. But I feel like in this moment, you're seeing that a bit of that like prickly language come through because her guard is a bit down.
Mm-hmm.
Because often when you're disabled, you can't be prickly about it. But I think her talking about like the ways that she's imagined her own death, and like, yeah, I don't know. It, like, there's this undertone, a little bit of edge
She mentions feeling old in a way that feels like a genuine slip, probably.
Yeah, I love this passage, and it's so easy to overlook because we get into that really sort of focused drawing eyes interaction that's so fraught. But the passage immediately leading up to that, she says, "You do look like a nice kid," which, what a thing to say to somebody you're planning to murder. "Sorry, you're not a child, but I feel so old right now. Did you see the pair from the fourth house? Babies. They've contributed to me feeling ancient. Tomorrow I might feel youthful, but today is a bad day."
Yeah.
I want to know everything about that string of sentences.
I feel that so hard. Yeah, the first time that I read this book was probably the sickest that I ever was. Like, I was in a really bad place physically there with specifically like lung related stuff. And I did so relate to Kithraea and also how like exaggerated and body horror her stuff gets near the end made me weirdly feel a lot better.
Like, there's a catharsis in seeing her as a disabled person have a huge amount of impact in this story. And her body's experience being a part of that, like indivisibly. So I think the part where it is telling the story of someone who is like their choices are now so informed by their navigating of their disability and their living of it that like it affects their entire known world in a way. Like we're seeing her have agency in a way that she has been fighting for.
Yeah, I think that that's really a big piece of it, that she has an incredible amount of agency and power and influence and is able to meet her goals, and she can't move the chair by herself. She, like, it doesn't magic away her disability. It doesn't overcome her disability. She is still just as disabled. She just also gets shit done.
I feel like she's a great symbol too for the feeling of I'm just done with this and I want to give up, but I can't. Like you're over it, you're fed up, but there's just absolutely no choice but to continue. And she's had to do that for 10,000 years. It's just this magnified version of like a very real reality.
And I think within queer literature, we are used to empathizing with the villain. Queerness is so often cast in peril. Like we don't, Kithraea isn't a queer-coded villain, but we are primed as queer readers and lovers of queer literature. I'm making a bunch of assumptions here, Caro, but I'm saying we're primed to relate to these characters, and she is there as an offering for us to relate to. She isn't designed to be the other.
I do strongly disagree that she's not queer-coded.
She flirts with Gideon a lot.
A lot.
Immediately.
Immediately.
I say she's not queer-coded, and more what I mean is she's not queer-coded in contrast for the purpose of identifying her as a villain. She is coded as a villain in different ways, but it's not her queerness that makes her villainous.
What do you think she means when she says she's having a bad day? Do you take that to be a comment about her symptoms being really bad?
I think there's a problem that she's having to solve, but she can't solve it herself, and she's having to deal with things she didn't expect, and it's annoying.
I wonder if it also might be a bad day, like mentally, in the sense that she does go into that kind of a little bit out of nowhere monologue about, like, isn't this place so weird and abandoned? And I wonder who used to live here. Like, I feel like she might be thinking back to the past a little bit and some feelings about that. Yeah.
Coming back to the first would have a lot of, like, how long has it been since she's been here?
9,000 years. Yeah, I think she's grappling with the fact that she is going to kill Isaac and Jean-Marie. And
That's true.
she
That's
did not
probably true.
expect children. She didn't expect teenagers. She was expecting to come and kill some adults who were conscious, devotees of the Imperial Project. And she was like, that's going to be what it is. And she's now like, I'm in it. Like, I am going to do it. I am going to kill them. But that sucks.
I didn't consider that, and you're probably right.
I think that the ghosts are also a big piece of it, though. Because, yeah, she has these thoughts about you know, the fourth are babies, and then immediately pivots into wanting to see Gideon's eyes.
Okay, so do we think, what do we think inspired her to ask? Like, do we think she already suspected who Gideon was?
It's such a good question, because I think, you know, Kithera was obviously scheming with Mercy and Blood of Eden and everything. And so she might have been aware of Wake's plan, but being a redhead isn't that rare, unless Gideon is literally the only redhead on the ninth, and just being a redhead was enough to make Kithera be like, okay, who's your dad?
Honestly, that's possible. Mm-hmm. Given, you know, it's recessive and there aren't very many people in the ninth house.
And she also mentions another recessive gene.
Do you think that Kithera has put together that this is God's child at this moment?
I think she must have. I'm not sure if that changes her plan.
What information would Kithera have about Gideon's existence prior to coming here?
She would know the plan.
Yep.
So she would know that it's possible that there is a child of John somewhere on the ninth.
Does Kithera know that John's eye color is Lictoral?
Oh, she wouldn't, would she? Because that was a big reveal for at least Mercy.
Yeah, I don't know if she would. I don't know what information she's getting out of the yellow eyes.
Like, she definitely figured out something that she didn't know before through this scene. And I'm genuinely not sure what it is, but it's important, but also doesn't change her plan, I think.
It might just be that she's learned that Gideon is not really of the ninth.
True. It feels like if she knew she was God's child, surely that would have factored in somehow to her whole thing. She'd want to send a message somehow with the manner of Gideon's death, or leave her alive to use her for something else or something, but she seems to treat her just like anybody else. Mostly.
Well, one thing is that she hasn't necessarily in this scene concluded what she wants to do with this information. She doesn't have to. And after living for 10,000 years, I imagine you do lose the sense of needing to solve things urgently when they're not urgent.
True.
Which I'm still working on. But I think she can recognize that she's at her leisure right now to decide what she wants to do with this realization.
Which, again, she does not feel threatened at all. So.
The scene makes me wonder how many of these kinds of conversations and encounters Kithera is having with other people.
That's true.
Because, of course, we don't see them. Yeah.
We talked about in our last recording, Ianthe having a sense that someone was there in the hallway when she and the other members of the third walked down and Gideon was overhearing their conversation. But we didn't conclude whether or not Ianthe knew who it was. It was just a mousetrap that she was setting. Mm-hmm. So we could probably assume that Kithera is force-sensitive enough to be like, ooh, someone with some real interesting energy is approaching. Her first interaction with Gideon, if we assume this kind of force sensitivity, might have been an initial like, oh, this is interesting, let's follow up.
That's true. Yeah.
And Gideon does touch her right away. Like, she catches her.
Given what we know that lictors perceive about the energy of living people around them, for sure Kithera would immediately spot Gideon as interesting.
She's got to be interesting, right?
And
she's got something going on.
Maybe she knows about the ninth baby plot, and she sees this red hair and she feels this weird energy and she's like, hold on, let me see your eyes. Okay, that's not what I was expecting. Huh. Okay. Because maybe at that point she was thinking it was God's kid, but she was expecting the black eyes.
That's true.
And she, I don't think, would have ever met Electo.
Oh.
If there Electos. Were nuns on the ninth when she was 13, Electo's gone.
Shoot, what the heck does she think is going on with the eyes?
I don't know.
No, this is all I'm going to be thinking about for the next 24 hours. The series loves its rare eye colors.
You know what? You know what? Who loves rare eye colors? Anybody who's writing magic.
True. Like, violet eyes in particular is such a trope thing, which honestly, I that's probably on purpose, right?
Heterochromia and violet eyes. It's a thing.
Uh-huh. give the love interest character violet eyes.
Having cosplayed characters with violet eyes, it's also like, tell me if this is the experience you have. As each piece goes on, you like, you feel the internal transformation. And putting your contacts in, I don't know if you put them at the beginning or the end, but they're like a big moment in a cosplay, you know, get ready ritual.
Do that. See, I hardly ever use contacts. I've like just recently gotten any contacts. So I do the like filter on TikTok. Cool. Or whatever, and that is like you turn that on and it's like, okay, now I'm the person.
And it does a switch in your brain of like
fully
thinking of yourself.
Yeah, the contacts are really big. I remember one time I accidentally fell asleep in my Gideon contacts, and when I woke up the next morning and saw myself in the mirror with the Gideon eyes, it was a big moment.
For my Gideon cosplay, I don't use really distinctly yellow ones. I had some from a previous cosplay that were like, my eyes are yellow with little bits of yellow, are green with little bits of brown in it. And so I use what was essentially like a very desaturated yellow tinted version of my own eye color. My contacts have this weird, like almost believable vibe to them, which like is a fun place to play when you're doing in-person interactions with color contacts. People are like, are those real? Maybe plays with the uncanny valley part of people's head because they can't fully identify that you are in costume.
Yeah, the Gideon eyes can get very cartoony depending on like how you do them, which is also kind of a vibe. So
yeah,
it's a vibe selection.
Yeah, I have like werewolf yellow contacts.
See, the ones that I got were two. They're like light yellow, and combined with the fact that I have like grayish blue eyes underneath, turn into this weird like sickly like greenish color in my eyes. They look really bad. So I think they work really well when I'm Kiriona. When I'm a corpse, they don't work so well for any of the characters who are alive. The specific type of yellow really sets a vibe.
Yes.
Well, can you tell me what characters of the Lock Tomb series you've cosplayed so far?
Which ones have I not? I think is maybe
I love it. Great. Okay.
I've done everybody. Okay, so I've done Gideon. I've done Gideon when she's dead and in Harrow's subconscious. I've done Kiriona. I've done young Gideon in the past. So those are all of my... And then I've done Harrow. I've done Gideon and Harrow's body. I've done Nona. I've done Electo, Kitherea, Jod, Pal, Cam, Wake, Ianthe, and Corona Beth. That might be it. Is that everybody? I gotta catch them all.
You've done Mercy.
Yes, Mercy. Ooh, I love doing Mercy, actually. She's really fun. I think that's it. That's gotta be it. No, it is challenging because I do think of them, like I think of Harrow the Ninth Harrow and Gideon the Ninth Harrow as like different characters when I'm like organizing them in my brain. Yeah. So I've got like different like categories for the different characters also as well.
Yeah, there's like the pre-Lictoral Harrow and the post-Lictoral Harrow are very different animals.
Oh, yeah. And then if you're in Harrow, you can also do Gideon in Harrow. Mm-hmm. But then that's also a completely different like vibe.
Gideon in Harrow is such a different vibe from regular Gideon as well.
Gideon in Harrow is extremely gendered to me. That's another one that I'm like, oh, yeah.
I feel like Gideon in Harrow is where my biggest fuck boy lives,
because she doesn't give a shit at that point.
Here's a fascinating thing that you discover as you start to cosplay. Your characters have different boundaries than you as a person do.
Yeah, well, I've never done in-person cosplay like around other people at all, and I feel like that must be so weird in a lot of ways, like interacting with people in character.
I've done the ones where I've done interactions have been like almost exclusively in digital context, where I have like interactions in characters. So I had a lot of control over my space. But I think, Han, you've probably had a lot more in-person in costume interactions than either of us.
Yeah, you've done to like cons and stuff, right?
I did a con day as Corona Beth, which was amazing. And I want to do more of that. And I did a con day in a much kind of lower impact Gideon, which was also fun. And like one person recognized Gideon, but was really excited about it, which was really fun. I'll link this artist, but Claire, it was the artist who did the Ianthe print that I have for you.
Oh, Oh, cool.
That artist was like, oh my God, you're Gideon. Can I have a picture of you? And I was like, hell yes.
That's awesome. So I want to kind of touch on the characters that we don't relate to that we cosplay, because I think this is a really interesting experience. If you don't cosplay, this thing happens when you do, when you put a costume on and you discover another aspect of yourself. And as you portray this character, even if you don't relate to them, you are drawing on usually an aspect of yourself to start to explore them. And so when I discovered Ianthe, like, first cosplaying Gideon was like embodying this kind of confident masculinity that was like some take, I swear to God, 10 takes just to like get into the movement. But Ianthe was like, I hate this bitch. She's awful. And then I put her on and I was like, I hate this bitch. She's awful.
I share your experience that Carol also mentioned. So I just want to highlight, this is literally all of us, of connecting a lot with Gideon's masculinity. There are videos of me in Gideon cosplay that are not even my favorite cosplays. Not even like, I feel like I did my makeup well that day, but there's ways that I'm moving and holding my face where I'm like, that's gender. That's it. That's exactly, good job, Gideon masculinity.
The ones where I'm being like smarmy, flirty Gideon were like, I was like, holy shit, what have I unlocked? There's this one where it's just like lowering her glasses and like eyebrows. Just like, I know you're obsessed with me. And then like the beat hits and eyebrow goes up. And I'm like, how do I do that?
I have so many of those in either Gideon or Kiriona where like I haven't even posted them, but I just look back on them. I'm like, that lives inside of me and I have to know that. Just this absolute fuckboy energy that I didn't, yeah. It was in there somewhere.
That is how you cosplay Gideon. You're like, I need to find my inner fuckboy. Okay, turn my hat backward, let's go.
But it's like an incompetent fuckboy. It's very endearing. Like, I love being Gideon. Gideon's probably my favorite character to like embody. I feel like it's such a like, just relax into it and it's like a warm bath. I love Gideon. I've always said there are two wolves inside of me, and one of them's Gideon and one of them's Harrow. And I was very much a like Harrow person up until a certain point, at which I kind of said like, fuck it, I am not gonna try and be this like very intellectual person anymore because I'm tired and burnt out and I can't anymore. And it's just like these two energies that fucking hate each other and fight all the time.
I feel
and
like
maybe they should kiss, I don't know.
If there are two wolves inside of me from this series, it might be Harrow Corona.
Oh, that's interesting. I love that.
Listen, it's weird in there.
I love that.
I'm trying to think of what my two wolves are, and like, I'm not being honest with myself because, well, like the first thing I was like, Nona and Magnus, and I'm like, nope, you're lying to yourself. And then I was like, maybe Nona and Ianthe. And then there's a part of me that's just like, can I just have one Paul?
Oh, just God. Paul. We all yearn to be Paul. Oh, I've done Paul. There you go. There's another one.
I did Paul!
I don't relate to Paul at all.
I found Paul incredibly comforting immediately.
I am excited for more from Paul. I feel like I don't know enough about Paul to have much of an opinion.
So
although
maybe
when
Paul
I
is a trap. Because that's... And that's the thing where I'm like, I love Paul, and that's dangerous in this universe.
I am cautiously attached to Paul, but oh boy.
Nope.
I will say I did a cosplay of Paul and was immediately like, oh, I am hot. Paul is so gender, like by design, and I love that about them.
Mm-hmm. I'm currently settling on, I have two wolves. One of them is Nona and one of them's Ordis.
Oh,
I predicted that one of your wolves would be Ordis. That sounds fair.
That's very good.
My cosplay stuff is mostly drag for me, so I feel like my cosplay experiences are not highly gender concordant, generally speaking.
I feel like that's the point a lot of the times, though.
Yeah, like the person who's the closest to my gender that I've cosplayed is probably Pyrrha.
I forgot you did Pyrrha. That was a good Pyrrha.
Can we quick, I don't know what your experience is with this, Caro, is, but I feel like your Pyrrha brings this topic up for me. Can we talk about the experience of cosplaying character feelings versus feelings about cosplayers when we know each other and our cosplaying feelings and our cosplaying relationships and like the nuanced skills required to navigate creating with friends and creating with people that you are very close with?
I have a crush on my friends.
The fun part.
So, there's a level of playing in the space that is always true, which is why, like, there are some people I won't do certain relationships with. Like, I will do Griddlehark with Hannah, and I don't do Griddlehark with anybody else. And my feelings about Griddlehark have changed because I've spent so much time blending that relationship with my actual marriage.
Like, that's an interesting
as a fan, I was like, I hope that they don't end up together. This is fucked up. She's literally enslaved. This is morally wrong. And now I'm like, make them kiss.
Now it's your wife. I remember I had a Griddlehark relationship prior to your Griddlehark relationship where when I was still the only person I knew cosplaying someone that I was in a relationship with digitally at the time, because it was during the pandemic, and that's made perfect sense then, surprised me with a Harrow cosplay and then just referred to me as Griddle basically for the rest of our relationship. And it was a very interesting experience of like, I'm actually relating to this not through the lens of the story, but they really strongly identified me through the lens of my cosplay. And it was becoming a TikTok cosplayer involves learning a bunch of relational skills because people are observing you, people are reacting to you, people are maybe having feelings and articulating them about you or your character that you don't want.
I think that the experiencing these characters as cosplay figures and as cosplayers is so distinct from experiencing them through the lens of like reading the book, because as I read the book, I'm like, these are teenagers. And as I am experiencing them as a cosplayer, I'm like, these are my 30 something friends. And
yeah,
like, through the lens of fan art, I'm like, this is horny. And through the lens of the original text, I'm like, this is a baby child who is small and sweet.
It's just like a lot that I wish someone my age who was cosplaying had come out and told me. But it is, get clear on who you want, like the age range that you're willing to cosplay these ambiguously aged relationships with, because it will become self-defined how you identify yourself in this character. And that does bear weight on the word appropriate, lacks the nuance that I want to have in this statement. But like, I'm not willing to cosplay romantic relationships with people that I, as an individual in my outside life, would treat as a child, which like honestly goes into your mid-20s. Like, I have friends that I respect their cosplays. They are young people doing beautiful work, and I will not have intimate duets with them because it makes me uncomfortable. But when I first got into cosplay, I was like, there are some boundaries that I need to have that no one's talked to me even need to, like, what the fuck, TikTok?
It's funny that we don't talk about it more because it is such a thing that everybody, I guess, is coming to by themselves.
I was desperate for conversations on how to navigate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm very selective with the types of duets that I'll do, like possibly too selective sometimes, because I'm like, I don't know how this is going to come across to this person. And, like, I've had a couple that I've like posted and been like, I don't know, I feel weird about it. Like, it's like kind of weird and fraught, and especially with the culture of like, you're not necessarily like asking before you post one all the time. Like, sometimes I will, but a lot of times I won't, and then it's like, is this okay?
Often I will, especially if it's more kind of flirty or like suggestive. Like, there's an Iante video that Claire posted that I still haven't duetted. It's still saved in my videos, and it's been saved in my videos for like 2 years. But it is a little bit like more sexy and suggestive, and it's posted as open duets. But I was like, given our relationship to each other and the fact that I would like to respond to this as your sister, is that okay?
That feels valid. That feels
I'm having a memory of an audio come back to me, and also a word that I learned through this fandom, which is twincest.
Yeah.
See, also
people feel different ways.
People do feel different ways. I found out that a lot of the fandom is really mad about Campal because they're cousins.
That surprises me so much too, because I feel like it's so inherently messed up in so many ways. How is this the thing that we're mad about?
I think Mir's a little bit aware of all of these things that we're navigating as a fan fiction writer.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they were presented in a soon coming chapter, Abigail and Magnus's relationship and the taboos associated with it, that is Mir saying this world has different taboos.
Mm-hmm.
That implicitly gives writers a space to say, well, what are they? What can we pull from the text? Because the taboos are explicitly different in this world. I have had my comfort most challenged in terms of fan content by fan fiction writers exploring in that space. This is, I think of Mir as a writer, and I'm like, these are things that in her development as a writer, she has also experienced and gone through.
And I think it's really interesting because the relationship that I have had the most sort of ethical difficulty with, the one that I find the most challenging, is Gretelhark. Because that's...
I would agree.
She owns her.
It's such a power dynamic thing, and it's such a... Like, they have such a history of, like, straight up, like, violence and abuse. Like...
Yeah. So Dulcinea says that Gideon is just the picture of Nonius, which is such a fucking sweet thing to say. She probably knew Nonius. She says, before I met you, I imagined you might be some wizened thing. And I think that that really speaks to, like, what she was expecting to see when she came to the first house, and especially from the ninth, because she, of course, would have known that all the kids died.
Mm-hmm. She was probably expecting basically a Glamine or Crux.
Yeah. And this is like a really different thing for her to encounter. And she's having, I think, a like really genuine encounter with Gideon's sweetness in this moment. But that is tinged with such a sense of sort of guilt and horror, knowing what she came there to do.
It does feel to a certain extent sincere, in the same way that I feel like the, when Gideon almost dies in the trial. Yeah. And I feel like her vibe there is a similar thing of just like, just genuinely, what a sweet child.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God, I have so many feelings about the Avulsion Chamber. I can't wait to talk about that.
That's a good one.
Kithorea immediately clocks that the way Gideon is holding this sword is not how you hold a rapier. Despite the fact that Gideon had talked herself through standing in the proper stance.
This is where I have written in my notes, get sword facts from sword folks. Hey, sword folks. Does this make sense?
It really makes sense. I actually have in arm's reach the exact thing that I need to show you how this makes sense. I have one tool that will show us both. So this is the sword that I teach, and it's called a messer. The fun thing about this is you can use one hand. And so holding a rapier is, your body is more in like parallel. One foot is forwards. One hand is down, your shoulders back. Holding a long sword, your body moves more like this. Your hand is down below. And you're going to be a bit more square because you have more coverage.
So that to me seems like it would be a lot more obvious than I was thinking too.
Yeah.
This is a
big expecting difference. Kind of subtle changes, but like
a draw that comes out. So Gideon draws and tries to get the form and then relaxes her body and like grabs the pommel. So what this would actually look like, here, let me grab my sword that's more rapier shape. Gideon's holding a sword more like this one. So there isn't actually room for two hands in his guard. This is a basket hilt, so it means that it's designed to protect the whole hand, and the pommel at the end is for balance, more than anything else. And so she's drawn this shorter blade, it's come in front of her body, and as she's relaxed and stopped coaching herself through the positioning, her hand has come looking for that long grip at the bottom, and all she has found is a pommel.
Resting in that, yeah, there you go.
And it looks kind of awkward, because there's nothing here to grab onto. And now my arm is awkwardly tight into my body, seeking that longer handle. And I'm kind of offline and not sure how to actually protect my body in this very unnatural way of holding this tool.
And it's noticeable. There you go. Okay. So that's realistic.
So Gideon's panicked.
Yes.
She is immediately emotionally transported back to childhood. She is feeling like she is late for prayers.
I was thinking Gideon honestly has pretty excellent trigger discipline on that vow of silence. Just like given the circumstances, I feel like if I was panicking, I would forget all about it.
For our non-US listeners, trigger discipline is a gun culture reference where you don't put your finger on the trigger of a gun until you're ready to pull the trigger. So good trigger discipline looks like having your finger placed somewhere other than the trigger when you are simply holding the weapon.
I said for like impulse control, basically. I'm from Texas. I don't know.
Well, it's training your body to recognize where your impulses are and to have your default position somewhere where your impulse is not going to lead to a consequence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Prevent accidents.
Totally.
Gideon is saved by Protesilaus coming in and speaking, which is interesting because I don't think we see Hera's parents speak, right?
I called that out in my notes, too. I forgot that he could talk.
I also
forgot. It feels very incorrect that he could talk.
It does. It's weird.
It also is completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
It's totally performative.
He could have just nodded.
But yeah. He does give us a clue about what he was doing.
So was this the study that was shut up with the perpetual bone? Do we think that's what he was shutting?
That's my suspicion, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he just says, it's shut.
Which, does that mean that she can do necromancy through Pro?
Oh, God, I didn't even think of that.
Can you take one step back and explain to me the experiment that you're talking about? Because I don't know what you're talking about.
Do you remember when Harrow and Palamedes try to get into a locked door and the lock has been all gummed up and Harrow was like, oh, it's totally no problem. I'll just like slorp it out of there. But then it's really hard to slorp.
It's really hard to slorp.
It's really hard. And it's because Kitherae put it in there. It's unslorpable. Because she's got fancy lictor powers.
Right. So she says they have keys. And if they unlock this particular door, then there's a lot more problems that I have to solve. So I'm going to prevent this now.
Because that's her lab, right?
I assume so. And maybe it has like a picture of her or something in it. I don't know what would be in there.
Yeah. It seems like she's gone through and like defaced some stuff to make sure that she's not going to get blocked.
Yeah.
And yeah, so Pro comes up and says it's shut. But then it does mean that she must be able to do necromancy via her meat puppet.
Can we have bodily objects imbued with necromancy to operate remotely from their necromancers?
Yes, because that is what Ianthe does. Oh my God, that's why it looks like she was asleep. Because she was winnowed into him. She was in there. She was doing it.
Oh shit. So he like extra didn't have to talk because she's the one that shut it.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
I don't know why she had him talk. I think it's so sad at the end of this chapter that Gideon clocks that Pro is looking at her with this empty disinterest. And she just takes it personally because she's so used to taking it personally. Instead of being like, there's something wrong with this dude. Yeah, she's like, this guy literally wouldn't care if I died.
And that's about me. And not about the fact that he's been dead for weeks. I love that Gideon just straight up runs away too, which is such a 17-year-old thing to do.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Caro. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.